Okay, we'll bring the Environment Natural Resources Committee to order. And Representative Poppy, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I certainly have. I would like to move the minutes.
Representative Poppy moves the minutes from February 1st. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails, minutes are adopted. Okay. Well, folks, today we're going to have a couple of bills up, and but before we get into that, we're going to have Ms. Lee Fan Mueller come forward. She's the director of the Ecological Services Division of the DNR, and she's going to have a little presentation for us, and then we'll move right into Representative Howell's bill.
Members of the committee, my name is Lee Samueler with the Division of Ecological Services and DNR, and Ron Pyre with the Division of Fish and Wildlife is also here with me today. And we were asked to give you an update on what's happening relative to management of double-crested cormorants in Minnesota as a precursor to the bill that you're going to hear on silencers on guns. So you should each have a handout on cormorants, Minnesota cormorants. And I was just going to walk through that with you briefly. Just before we get into that, a little bit of background. The double-crested cormorant is a native species to Minnesota. Has occurred here as long as records go back to the explorers and beyond. There's actually points on some lakes that are called Black Duck Point, which no doubt did refer to the presence of cormorants back at the turn of the century. Cormorants were historically very, very abundant in Minnesota when you go back to historical records. And we probably have not, the current population levels, which I'll talk about in a minute, probably don't come close to what the population was at the turn of the century. So that's just a little bit of historical context. If you look at slide number 2, cormorants are not protected under Minnesota state law. They are listed officially as an unprotected bird. But they are protected under federal law, under the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act, with amendments, 1972 amendments to that federal law. And as a result, we cannot take cormorants in Minnesota without federal approval. So that's really key to all the rest that follows here. Even though it's not protected in Minnesota, the federal law prevails. Cormorant populations declined at the turn of the century, largely because of unregulated shooting, and then continued to decline in the 60s because of DDT. They were very susceptible to DDT poisoning. But they have been on the rebound since then. Since about when I started my job in the 70s, we had a handful of cormorant colonies in the state. We have a number of them now. They've grown quite a bit, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But they are rebounding, and the question is, are they going to continue to rebound more, or have we reached a level where that's going to be stable for a while, and we don't know that right now. But what we saw in the 80s, both Ron and I and our colleagues started to get calls back in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, mostly from aquaculture folks, because aquaculture industry was starting to increase in the late 80s, early 90s, and that's like putting a welcome sign out to fish-eating birds. You have a lot of fish in a very tight area, and for birds, particularly like cormorants, that's a real easy target. And we started to get a lot of complaints in the late 80s, early 90s from folks in the aquaculture industry, and it results in a lot more conflicts and complaints. Well, in the late 90s, the Fish and Wildlife Service established the Aquaculture Depredation Order. And what that did was authorize aquaculture producers, as well as federal and state hatchery operators in 13 states, including Minnesota, to shoot cormorants committing or about to commit depredations on aquaculture stocks and their properties. In Minnesota, the number of cormorants that are taken under this depredation order has been about 1,200 to 2,000 birds per year. It's varied quite a bit. We just got a report in the last week about the take for 2004, and it was 2,000 birds. So it's been holding fairly steady. For a number of years, probably about 4 or 5 years after that depredation order was placed into effect, the phone calls stopped. We weren't hearing much. But if you turn to the next page, meanwhile, the cormorant population did continue to grow some, and we started hearing concerns from commercial fishing industry and recreational anglers about the potential impacts that the growing cormorant populations were having on fish populations. So what this led to in the late 90s was the beginning of the preparation by the Fish and Wildlife Service of a federal EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, to assess the impacts that cormorants were having on fish populations. Just a little over a year ago, in November 2003, the Fish and Wildlife Service published its final EIS, in which it selected its preferred alternative. And that alternative was to establish a new depredation order that focused on public resources, not just the aquaculture resources. And essentially what that public resource depredation order does is establish conditions under which authorized agents, which include state fish and wildlife agencies, federally recognized tribes, and the USDA, can legally take actions to reduce the occurrence or minimize the risk that cormorants have on public resources. And public resources are defined as fish, wildlife, plants, and their habitats. So that was November 2003. There's various conditions that apply in the federal rule that was published, including first and foremost, before any action is taken, landowner's permission is required. No federal permit is needed. That's the real purpose of this depredation order. But the Fish and Wildlife Service needs to be notified of any actions. And then if there's actions at a breeding colony to reduce the population by more than 10%, there's additional reporting requirements that are required. So what's happened in Minnesota since November 2003? Well, the following spring, we convened all the authorized agents in Minnesota, which was the USDA, our state fish and wildlife agency, and every recognized federal tribe, to talk about what our strategy would be, because we were beginning to hear more concerns, particularly around the Leech Lake area, some along Lake Superior, and we wanted to be prepared. And we also wanted to be working together. By the law, we could actually be working independently, but we decided as a group it was pretty important that we were working together. And we outlined several tasks, which included we were going to do a statewide population survey, which had never been done before, and do that in the 2004 field season. And because most of the concern right then was at Leech Lake, we were going to support the tribe in its efforts to reduce breeding habitat at a site in Leech Lake that I'll talk about in just a minute. Now, the results of the 2004 field survey was that we had 16,152 nesting pairs found at 35 nesting colonies in the state. The colonies are found along Lake Superior shoreline and on islands in some of the bigger lakes like Leech Lake and Lake of the Woods, as well as on some small islands and some of the smaller inland lakes, primarily in west central Minnesota. The next picture just shows you a big picture of Leech Lake. And that tiny little green dot in the middle of the picture is Pelican Island and Little Pelican Island, and that's where the cormorants nest. And the following slide shows you a bigger enlargement of that picture. The island, in this case, Little Pelican, is only 3 acres in size. It's owned by the Leech Lake Tribe, and it also supports, from a resource standpoint, one of our biggest concerns is it supports one of only 4 common tern breeding colonies in the state. And common terns, unlike its name, is pretty uncommon throughout the Great Lakes region, and we're putting a lot of management focus on common terns. The interesting thing that really makes Leech Lake stand out from a lot of other colonies in the state is that the population there has literally exploded. We've seen gradual increases in most of the other colonies in the state, but Leech Lake has literally exploded in just a few years. The population grew from about 73 nests in 1998 to 1,100 in 2003 to 2,500 in 2004. And there's a lot of reasons for why that's happened, but it is really unique in terms of all the cormorant colonies in the state. And the tribe has been trying to work for several years to reduce the attractiveness of the island to cormorants so that it would provide more habitat for common terns, but they've been losing that war, so to speak. Then I want to talk a little bit, we're going to have Ron Pyre talk to you a little bit about the fish population up in Leech Lake, some of the concerns there.
Been a lot of concern on not only
Pyre,
please
state your name.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Pyre with the Fish and Wildlife Division of the DNR. there's been a growing concern with cormorant numbers not only on Leech Lake but Lake of the Woods and a number of other lakes due to the increasing number of cormorants. And we didn't have a lot of data that would indicate cormorants had a major impact. The diet studies that had been done indicated a small percentage of the consumption was walleye, a lot of yellow perch. But as we looked at Leech and we saw what was happening with the cormorant population, we started seeing some trends. The overall walleye abundance started dropping below the population goals. One of the key points is there's no strong year class, a hatch in a given year since 1997. That's really unusual on our big lakes. Generally, we don't go more than five or so years without seeing a nice year class. We had a big year class in 2001. And they were growing well, they showed up well in our assessments, and they disappeared, and that corresponded with a large increase in the cormorant. There's not very many walleye because of that in that less than 15-inch range. But the brood fish, there's an adequate number of spawning walleye in the lake right now, but they'll phase out, and there's not much coming behind them, and that's our concern. So we're going to implement a slot limit this coming spring to try to protect those brood fish and see if we can get a year class coming through. Walleye fishing has been tough for 3 years. Those of you from up in that area certainly know that, and will continue to be tough. It takes about 4 years for a year class to recruit into the fishery. Yellow perch abundance has also been diminished, and perch are a major food item. You'll swing over to page 9. That's where we just start seeing some graphic depictions of what's going on. And the first graph is our test netting, and these are gill nets, and they'll take walleye that are maybe 12 inches and larger. And you can see the last peak there in about 1999 would indicate that strong 1997 year class coming through, and the numbers have been dropping steadily off since then. The graph below that is trawl catches, and these are smaller fish. These would be fish that are probably same year hatch or the year after, and you can see again we captured the 97 year class, the big spike in 1998, but then they've steadily dropped off. And the next page on 10 is just another depiction of where our management goal is for walleye less than 15 inches, and you see it's dropping down below, not necessarily past some historical levels, but it's below an area where we'd like to see it. And with nothing else coming in, it's interesting because what we see in the deeper water portions of the lake, and the cormorants do feed mostly in the main body of the lake, that's where we see the most marked declines in the fish populations. In the deeper water portions of the lake, the populations have held up better than that. And the last chart is simply a depiction that we're seeing the same thing with yellow perch, and it's marked because these are perch that are 9 inches and bigger, and that's the size anglers like to take. Most of the food studies that I've seen, cormorants will take 70-80% of their diet as yellow perch. Perch kind of drive the system. That's the food base for walleye, for northern, most of the other predators that anglers like to see. So, you know, we've got a good basis to have reproduction in the lake. We need to protect those brood stock, and we will talk a little bit more about how we plan to do that.
To turn to page 11, one of the things that we've done now is establish a preliminary target for cormorant population on Leech Lake. And again, this is all done with the tribe and the USDA and the DNR. And our preliminary management goal is to look at about 250 to 750 nesting pairs. And that population level is about the level at which before we started to see declines in the walleye and yellow perch population. So that's how that was decided. And what we're doing right now is we've got several pronged approach in terms of our management plan for cormorants up there. There is a federal environmental assessment being done on the action up there because, again, this is the land is owned by the tribe, and the action, the management actions to control the population is being done by the USDA. And under NEPA, those federal agencies need to do a federal environmental assessment. We are currently working on developing a variety of effective control strategies, which will include shootings from adults, which is why you're going to hear the silencer bill in a few moments. We're also going to be oiling eggs up there because that's a very effective way to stop reproduction. When you oil eggs, the birds continue to incubate and don't re-nest, but they don't bring off any young. And by not bringing off young, that will significantly reduce the number of cormorants feeding on the lake in late summer. We're going to begin the control effort in 2005, pending completion of the federal EA. And we also have a pretty rigorous diet study underway because we do want to further understand what the relationship is between the cormorants and the fish in the lake. We're going to start work before that diet study is done, but that management goal we set may be adjusted based on the outcome of the study. And finally, one of the things on the last page, page 12, is we recognize that cormorants are only one issue on the lake, and we think a really integrated approach to the issues on Leech Lake is really critical as we move forward. Fisheries, as many of you know, has instituted special regulations to protect the walleye stock, brooding stock on Leech Lake. We will begin a control program. We also have a small stocking program with fry on the lake, and those fry will be marked. So when we do the diet analysis of cormorants, we'll know which of those we'll be able to tie that to the cormorant diet piece. And we're also very serious about habitat protection and management actions. And Representative Howell's in the audience, he knows that we're very aggressive about the Aguachine shoreline property up there, and that's certainly a key piece to what we see, is protecting shoreline habitat is just important to providing good fisheries up there, as finding a sustainable level between the fish population and the cormorants. So that's a real quick overview. Any questions?
Representative Howell, Representative Guineas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sam Mueller, why could we sustain such a large cormorant population in the early 1900s? I mean, what's the difference here? Obviously, it was sustainable then.
Mr. Chair and Representative Guineas, I'm not sure we have all the answers, but clearly we didn't have the pressures on lakes that we do today. I think our whole fisheries populations have changed in many ways. Actually, there's a book that's kind of the Bible of the history of birds in Minnesota. And when you go back to that book, you find there's stories about cormorants by Carlos Avery, who was the first game warden in Minnesota, and all the letters that he got back in the 30s about cormorants and the problems that cormorants are providing. So probably back in the 1800s, we didn't hear about conflicts, but by the 1920s and 30s, there were already conflicts between sportsmen and fisheries folks. And
I understand, but what was it about our lakes back in that time that could sustain that many cormorants? Because if there weren't fish available, they would have died off. So there must have been there must have been a huge amount of fish available in Leech Lake at the time. Are you all looking at that?
Emily?
Mr. Chair, Representative Guineas, what we are looking at is one of the reasons Leech Lake is a good lake to study is we've got really excellent fisheries data, and we can get a good sense of what the fisheries population is and what is sustainable. We don't know how many cormorants were here in Minnesota before. We have a huge migrating population that goes up to the wetlands in the Canadian Prairie provinces, and how much the early accounts were about migrants versus nesting birds, we don't know, because we have nothing. The 2004 survey we have nothing to compare to. Mm-hmm. So we just have these historical accounts, and a lot of them were during migration. So I don't have a good way to answer your question because we really don't have any good baseline.
Representative Clausey.
I have a question about the walleye. I grew up about 5 miles from Lake of the Woods, and I understand that I know about the cormorants there and the terns and the white pelicans. There's quite a number of new populations. I guess my question is regarding walleye. On Lake of the Woods, there's no commercial fishing anymore, as I understand it, unless something's changed. But there's commercial fishing on Leech Lake. Does that have something to do with this, or has the Lake of the Woods, has those fishing interests, which would be recreational, have they requested any help like this to get rid of the cormorants, or what would be different between a non-commercial fishing lake and a commercial fishing lake?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salzy, We did eliminate. There is no commercial walleye fishing on Lake of the Woods, and the void has been picked up by recreational anglers, and we've actually, we're taking more walleye now than we did even when the commercial and recreational interests were both operating on the lake. Leech Lake does not have a commercial walleye fishery. There are some subsistence nettings by Leech Lake band members. We've looked at that and don't believe that's having any impact on the population. So I don't believe the commercial aspects of Lake of the Woods or Leech Lake are a factor in what's going on with the walleye right now.
And the second part of my question is, have you been requested for some assistance like this on Lake of the Woods, or is there a different problem there, or why is Leech Lake different than from Lake of the Woods? Have the recreational fishing interests there requested some assistance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salzy, we haven't had a direct request yet, but there's certainly a lot of interest up there. One of the issues that we face up there is a relatively small proportion of the cormorant population is on the United States side, the Minnesota side of Lake of the Woods. So you go just a few miles across the border and there's a lot more birds there, hundreds of thousands of birds. And so eventually we'll need to address the issue. There's certainly constituent interest. I think what's driving Leech Lake more is we are seeing some issues with the walleye population. Lake of the Woods, we're not seeing a similar type issue with young fish coming in. So I imagine at some point we will be dealing with Lake of the Woods and trying to address that situation.
If I might just add, we've actually tracked cormorant populations fairly well on Lake of the Woods over the years, and what we've seen on Leech Lake with the birds going like this, we've seen ups and downs in Lake of the Woods, and they've not really had this exponential growth. In fact, they're down from what they were maybe 5 years ago.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Chair, what would you say would be the percentage of the problem with walleye related to the cormorant population? Is it a major factor? Is it 50% of the problem? Is it 10% of the problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, that's really difficult to say. If you would have asked that question a year and a half ago, I would have said and did say that I didn't think it was a very significant impact, but we're estimating that cormorants on Leech Lake are consuming somewhere between 11 and 12 pounds per acre. And most of the studies will say 1 to 2%, maybe 3% of their diet is walleye, which is relatively small. But if they can focus on those fish and you extrapolate that over the course of the year, they can have an impact. And studies in Oneida Lake and in New York, some of the other northeastern lakes have shown that they're finding that there's a direct correlation between cormorant numbers and smallmouth bass, walleye, perch numbers. And when they've controlled the cormorant population, they've seen a year class come back almost instantaneously. Coupled with that and the doubling on Leech Lake, we think it has an impact. Our speculation is it has a fairly significant impact. I couldn't put a percentage to that. I would say that it's clearly not the only impact on walleye. There's water clarity issues. It's actually clearing up what that does with forage base. There's the habitat issues that are changing as we all face how we handle a wise development of our waters. There's a host of issues. So we believe at this point in time that it certainly is a more serious issue than we would have said a year and a half ago.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So part of this is just sort of we're gaining more knowledge as we go along. Obviously, if we put into gear kind of a higher cormorant control practices, we should be able over time to track what kind of impact. But it sounds like there's also ongoing work that we need to be doing in other areas to understand, to be able to answer my question with much more clarity. What are the important steps that need to happen in the next year or two, say, with cormorant control? And how long would you anticipate seeing some kind of a market some kind of changes, marketable or measurable changes.
Samuel?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what we hope to do just the very first year is to begin to control some level of adults. We're not sure what the target is yet. We're working on that now. But to significantly reduce reproduction, because when you think of 2,500 nesting pairs, that's 5,000 adults, and if each one of those nesting pairs has 2 to 3 young, there's, you've immediately added another 7,500 birds to the population. So we think by controlling the reproduction significantly the first year, that will begin to have an effect on consumption this year. We think it's going to take the 3 to 5 year program to see the results that we're hoping for. And if we don't see the results we're hoping for, that will in part be an indication that the cormorants are contributing less to the problem than we think. And that's why we really are looking at this as an adaptive approach. We'll get more information from the diet study. We'll be able to monitor the fish populations, and all that information will help modify and as we go along.
Mr. Byer.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add to that as well. There's a number of things we have to be conscious of. You're very correct. And one is we have a lot of migrating birds that stop in the spring and the fall. And what we're doing is controlling numbers on a given site in a colony. And so we're not sure if we can do anything about it. The other thing we need to be conscious about is if we do move birds, or if we start controlling birds, are they simply going to cause a problem somewhere else? Are we going to move them to another lake, Winnebagoshish or Bemidji? And that may happen anyhow because they're expanding, but there's a lot of things that we need to track through this and try to get a handle on the best way to manage it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Dill?
How are the, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Van Mueller, how are the Canadians reacting to this? I mean, when you've got a lake of the woods is half, and where we live is all half border lakes, Rainy Lake. I have a cabin on Rainy, and out my front window is just, I mean, it's just black. You know, all the bare rock islands are covered with them, and you could shoot a case of shells in a half an hour over there, exterminating them. I mean, they're how are they reacting to this? Are they having a similar problem? And if we start taking birds out of the population in parts of Minnesota, will the birds that migrate through find new opportunity and just replace them?
Samuel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, those are all good questions. And the Canadians are, we're looking at a Great Lakes population. So what's happening in the Canadian provinces that border the Great Lakes is what we're seeing in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. So they're also at various stages in terms of how they're addressing it. They don't have similar depredation order, but there are control activities occurring at some select colonies, none that I'm aware of in Rainy Lake or Lake of the Woods, but further to the east they're doing some major control efforts on a couple of sites along the shore of Lake Superior. It's all part of the challenge is that we are kind of authorized to act independently, but we're talking about a regional population, and that's one of the reasons it's really important to keep the Fish and Wildlife Service to have some level of control in this, because they're going to be authorized. They're the ones who are bringing all of us together to really look at what's happening on a regional basis in terms of the population. So we'll have to see as we go along. Like I said, this is really the first year that something's happened. Even Canada has only recently begun some work, so this is all pretty recent, about a year to 2 years at best into the process.
Representative Dill.
Okay, I think you answered the question. Thank you. We don't have any experience then as to whether, let's say that on Leech Lake you take out 10% of the population and then you have a migration, and the birds that were north or the birds that were south find new opportunity on the same place, and we're right back to the same level. We don't have any experience in that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, that's exactly right, which is why we're entering new territory here in terms of what the birds do. But I think part of what's happened at Leech Lake and why it's so different from the other colonies is some of the habitat work that's been done on the island to improve it for terns has also been another welcome sign to the cormorants, and we've stopped the birds who are going to migrate up to the prairie provinces in Canada and created better habitat for those migrants. So those are the things that are all in play.
Thank you.
Representative Guineas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the walleye question. Have you tested Leech Lake, or I assume you've tested Leech Lake for the chemistry of the water, and are you finding any of the pesticides that act as endocrine disruptors in the water?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guineas, not that I'm aware of.
Have you tested?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I'll be clear on it. We do test the waters, and we have not found any evidence of the endocrine disruptors.
And you've tested as low as, say, one part per billion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I'm not sure of the parameters of the test. We can check on that and see what we've done.
I would appreciate that because we know now that frogs, the reproduction changes at that low level. And now I understand fish have been shown to change the reproduction at that low level. So I think that's one of the things that we need to understand, if that is also a factor in play here. Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Van Miller, I was going to save my question for Representative Howell, but it seems like you actually might be able to answer it better. The picture that we have of Little Pelican, first, it was taken in the summer. Is that true?
Correct.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Van Miller. Then degradation of the habitat in that only a very small amount of this island is green in the summertime, is that the result of it being all rock, or is that the result of the cormorant?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, there actually used to be more green on that picture, but the cormorants were nesting in the trees when they first began nesting on this colony, and one of the tribes' initial habitat actions was to cut down the trees in the belief that that would eliminate habitat for the cormorants. Cormorants nest both in trees and on the ground, and unfortunately it had the opposite effect and created more ground nesting habitat for the cormorants. So part of what you see is a modified habitat, but most of that is now great nesting habitat for terns and for cormorants and for ringbill gulls and for white pelicans, all of which nest up in this area.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Van Mueller, then just a real quick follow-up. What have the common tern accepted this great influx of cormorants, and have they continued to grow also?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, no, and that's the real problem, is the cormorants and the gulls, but more recently the cormorants have expanded, and what the terns like is that really, if you look to the left of that picture, that really nice, clear, the very sandy spit, that when you find terns, they're usually nesting on the very end and tip of an island, and they've just been moved out and out and out, so that we're at risk of losing this common tern colony in the next few years because they've declined.
Okay.
Regarding, I think you said the USDA was doing the control currently. So they're boiling the eggs? I've heard of shaking eggs, but I've never heard of boiling the eggs.
Samuel? Representative, I said boiling.
Boiling, okay, I get it. Okay, because for Canada geese, there's a control mechanism to shake the eggs. So is the Leech Lake Band doing egg shaking? Or, I mean, since they're nesting on the ground, I would think that would be a pretty easy thing to do. Are they doing that? Or the USDA, is anybody doing that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we don't have the authorization to do that yet, and that's why this federal environmental assessment is being done as we speak. So the control efforts won't begin until this summer, and the egg oiling, nothing has happened in that regard. Only some habitat work, but no control of adults and no egg oiling. We collected about 200 adults last fall for the diet study under a scientific permit, but that's the only work that's been done to date.
Okay, thank you.
One last thing, an idea. Maybe we could boil those eggs, and then we could sell them and put the money back in the budget, Mr. Chairman. You know, surely they could use them at the local bars in those beer teenies.
It's a slow way.
Representative Mariani, do you have another question?
Representative Bill, you can put me down for a dozen. So oiling eggs, shaking eggs, ultimately, what is the most effective way to control the reproduction? Is it shooting them? Is it oiling? Is it shaking? Is it some other? What are the most effective practices that have been used elsewhere?
Samuel?
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, Mr. Pye and I are going to a meeting in a couple of weeks to find out.
Okay.
There's people are experimenting with different techniques, and the agouriline is over 90% effective in terms of stopping reproduction. But in some cases, it may not bring the population down fast enough without taking adult birds, depending on what your objectives are. But taking adult birds, people think it's a real easy thing, and these birds are smart, and you just don't go out and shoot 1,000 birds on a Friday afternoon. So,
you're smarter than your average bird.
Yeah, you're very smart.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Bamula. Thank you, Ms. Pryor. Very good. Representative Lester.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just a question that's kind of come up here as this discussion's progressed. What would be wrong with opening up a hunting season in this isolated area versus having the DNR just have to try to sneak around and find them? We can have hunters do it for free.
Well, Chairman, Representative, we have had that idea along with a number of others broached to us, and we're not sure that that's the best way to actually control the populations. You can certainly get folks out there and get the migrating birds, but what we want to do before we would consider something like that is take a look at how can we control them without moving the problem somewhere else and without disturbing terns and some of the other birds. So I think that's an option that is certainly sitting there, but it's not something we'd look at right away until we figure out what is the best mechanism. And New York, when I talk to the fisheries managers out there, will say, you know, you can get your numbers of cormorants down, but it's an ongoing problem. This is something we're going to need to be able to address over the long haul, because you have to keep after it. And so we're looking at something that's sustainable as well as something that's just kind of an instantaneous control method.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Good job, guys.
Yeah.
Representative Hall, are you still awake over there? Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair? Over here. Representative Norris.
I just had a quick comment while Representative House is coming up. Representative Marquardt actually has Cormorant Lake in his district. There is a Cormorant Lake in Minnesota, also a Cormorant Village. So they're not included in this bill.
Mr. Chair, I've actually got a Cormorant Lake in my district, so Marquardt can't have the only one.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Okay, members, before we get started on Representative Howell's bill, I want to introduce our new page. We have Arlene Restad. Want to give us a wave, Arlene? She's going to be our new page. Welcome her to the committee. Representative Howells, I will move House File 42, recommended to pass, and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee. Is that the correct motion?
That would be correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Very good. And then you have an amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Howells has Amendment 8004-2A1. I will move that amendment to get it in the shape that the author would like. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Representative Howells, what did your bill now do?
Mr. Chairman and members, my bill will allow for the control of wildlife for federal, state, local, and or tribal government agencies to use a silencer for that control. And that's pretty much it. It's pretty simple. It's pretty basic. We had a little different language in the original bill, but working with the DNR and others, this language is much more comfortable to them. I will tell you that this bill, if it were to pass, a government entity could use this for things other than the cormorant with properly trained people. So this bill is not necessarily just for the cormorant in my district, but that was the initiative.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Spalding.
Yeah, why wouldn't we have it just for the cormorants in your district, or if we don't know of another problem? Could it be limited to Leech Lake, which is where the problem exists? As I understand, it doesn't exist on Lake of the Woods, so I'm just kind of wondering.
Representative Spalding.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative can't read that. Thank you.
I
suppose that's something that could be done, but my experience here is someone would be back a year from now or 2 years from now to change it. This allows state, federal, tribal, local governments to use this if necessary. It already is legal for certain police officers, SWAT teams, and that kind of, you know, for criminal activity. But, you know, the DNR is constantly having problems with overpopulation of deer. And I think they're looking at this as a possibility for that also. It's not just limited to the cormorants on a leash lake.
Representative Western?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same question, Representative Howes. Would you be amenable to allowing the DNR to open up special seasons for this, too? It seems to me that is truly what their focus should be, is managing the wildlife. And, you know, the United States of America's way to manage isn't like Germany, where we pay people to have a profession of hunting. We let the citizens hunt. Why don't we open that up as an option for the DNR to open up their contained hunting season on these birds as well?
Well, Representative Weston, I think I'll handle that, and Representative Howes can jump in too if you'd like. The issue is with the cormorants, you go out to shoot the cormorants and you have one blast of a rifle or whatever and they all fly away. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need the silencer issue, so that you can set up a blind somewhere and start picking some of them off. And that's why we need the silencer, and I don't think we want to make it legal for silencers for the general public. So this is just contained to peace officers. That answer your question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, that's the same as geese and ducks and anything. When you have one blast, they take off and scatter, and you get your one opportunity in a couple hours. My bigger question would be just why don't we make that an option, too, that they could open it up for a limited hunting season, a limited hunting area. It'd be less expensive in the long run if they decided to go that route versus paying several officers to have to stay out there and hunt these birds.
Representative Hall, do you have additional comments?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I agree with you 100%, and I would like very much to get this bill passed so we can bring the walleye population back up on Leech Lake, and Representative Lester might be more than happy to join you in a bill that would open hunting for cormorants.
Chairman.
After my bill passes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill?
Well, I would support having this being a statewide initiative, because this isn't the only animal population that needs to be controlled and is difficult to control. I'll give you an example. In our municipal airport, every deer in that part of St. Louis County loves to be eating the grass during the fall along the runway where it's manicured during the summer. And the airport, the DNR, issues a permit for taking the deer that are problem deer. And so there's 15 deer along the runway, and you shoot one and they all run away, and then your operator goes home. And then by the time he gets home for supper, there are 14 deer now on the runway. And, you know, you could be much more efficient. The local unit of government could be much more efficient at this.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably missed it when DNR was testifying, but did they say they support this bill?
Representative Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, yes, they do.
Any further questions? Anyone wishes in the audience that would wish to speak for or against the bill? With that, I would renew my motion that House File 42 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members.
Your bill is moving on to the Policy Finance Committee. I guess I should say as amended. Thank you. Okay. Representative Cornish. Representative Cornish moves House File 215. And let's see, where my Representative Cornish moves House File 215 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee. Correct, Representative Cornyn?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, we've got House File 215 is the DNR Enforcement Agency bill. What I'd like to do is give a basic explanation of the bill.
Should we, which one of these amendments would you like to do first?
Well, I've got, Mr. Chairman, one oral amendment and two written. And
all right.
Whatever order you'd like to take them.
Well, let's get it in the shape you'd like first. Let's take the oral amendment first. Oral amendment first.
Mr. Chairman and members, the oral amendment first. And what I'll do is introduce Pat Watts, the policy and management analyst from the DNR and Enforcement Division, and let her explain it, if that's okay.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This oral amendment was an agreement that was reached with the Minnesota Firearms Instructors Association. It was a request that they had. There was some concerns with the fingerprinting provisions that we were including for background checks. And to do the amendment, beginning on page 1, line 23, you would delete if, and then continue deleting the language through page 2, line 4. And then on page 2, line 12, after check, insert expiring 1 year from the date of signature. What that will mean is we'll have to get those, the background checks that we're able to do, we'll need to get them done within a year of the date of signature, or we'll have to seek their permission again. And that was agreed to, you know, by our safety training staff and with the instructors.
Okay. Mr. Helen, do you have that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. On the First Amendment, the oral amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Representative Cornish, you want to take the A1 amendment next?
That'd be fine.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this A1 amendment, I believe actual changes start on page 2, and it's a moving some statute language 169 and 169A, and then a item down the line 32 to do with seizure and forfeiture. I'll let Ms. Watts explain.
Watts?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the change on page 2, line 17 is a very, 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 very technical correction. I truthfully am not sure why we didn't discover it until 5 years after the fact, but during the revisor's instructions in the DWI recodification bill, there was instructions to change in the voting laws to say chapters 169 and 169A. We missed it, and this one for the ATV and snowmobile, it's just a correction to catch up to that. It's just a very technical correction. Then on lines 32 and 33, actually both of these two provisions are what were left of a second enforcement bill that, because of the number of items that were removed from the bill prior to the time it left the department, those are the two last sections. This will allow us to seize and forfeit trailers with the boats during the DWI processes that are currently in law. Boats are very troublesome. They're hard to trailer. The boats come typically in a package with boat, trailer, and motor. We've had bad things happen, like had to borrow the owner's trailer, blow a tire, have to buy two new tires to replace the trailer, then give the trailer back. Can't find a trailer for a large pontoon boat, have to borrow a marina's one to get it back to a storage facility. It's just, there's a lot of monkey business. They're typically financed together as a package. This would just make our work a lot easier.
Any questions on that amendment? On the Cornish A1 amendment. Okay, all in favor of the Cornish A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Okay, we're going to call the next Cornish amendment the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chairman and members, the A2 amendment It's some technical language about using charitable gambling funds for the purchase of supply and materials for safety training educational programs. I guess I can explain this one, and if there's technical questions, I'll let Ms. Watts answer them. But the problem here was in charitable gambling for years, law enforcement agencies haven't been able to use funds. This is an exemption, and it's not to purchase any law enforcement equipment, just to make sure you're sure. It's supplies and materials for safety training and educational programs coordinated by the Department of Natural Resources, including the Enforcement Division. So it lets the law enforcement agent here an exemption for this, but it's not for equipment, guns, trucks, ATVs. It's just for supplies and materials for safety training for these educational programs. And Ms. Watts, why don't you explain what's above that in the grant and aid trail maintenance and grooming? Watts, if that's okay.
Mr. Chairman? In working with the Gambling Control Board, they also have a bill that will be in process that they were going to combine. If you look on page 7, starting on lines 23 through 33, the Gambling Control Board was combining those two paragraphs and the new safety training paragraph that we had on lines 8.19 through 8.21 in the current bill. They were just restructuring, combining the DNR pieces and putting them together. We've worked with the wildlife folks, the Trails and Waterways folks, and the gambling staff as well as enforcement. We believe this amendment has language worked out where it will work properly for us. But it's just streamlining what was already there and trying to combine it a bit.
Any questions? Cornish, A2 amendment. All in favor of the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Cornish, can you tell us what your bill is now on House File 215 as amended?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'll just go down a basic explanation. In the safety training program, unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world anymore where we used to be able to hire instructors on just a handshake and trust for background. Dealing with kids nowadays, we have to make sure that we keep undesirables out of the system. And there has been a couple of instances where we've run into a little problem with a background check. Right now, the DNR is only able to do a kind of a cursory check. Public information, what's available, but they want to do a more in-depth background check, and this bill will allow them to do that. After I get done through these points, I can take any questions if you'd like. The next one is the ATV size. It used to be that it had to be a certain size. Now we're clarifying language that the you may use any size ATV for the riding component of the ATV training course. Next is technical changes relating to the requirement to adopt rules on course content and hold classes in certain locations. Fourth, we want to clarify that a previous hunting license used to demonstrate that when a person came in to buy a hunting license, if they want to use that as proof that they've had safety training or were able to purchase a license previously under the regulations, we would like it to have an identifier. So it clarifies that you have to have a firearm safety training indicator, on the license if you're going to use a license. Number five, clarify that 11-year-olds can obtain hunting licenses after completing a firearm safety course, but it's not valid for hunting until the person reaches age 12. In other words, if you pass a course and you get a certificate, for administrative and ease purposes, we mail them out to them right away, but we don't want them naturally to use it or buy the license or hunt until they actually turn 12 for a variety of reasons, both maturity and gun handling. And finally, we've covered that one already in the amendment. One thing I want to explain, I know I saw some people raising their eyebrows at the motor boat subject to seizure and forfeiture. This make it look like we're extending our power, but the problem is when we seize that equipment, it runs into a huge problem for conservation officers to seize a boat and have no way to transport it in. And unless the state wants to buy the DNR jet ski trailers, snowmobile trailers, and boat trailers in some new initiative, We have our case with the problems of having put in a lot of equipment in the back end of a truck and paying damage for it. In the past, I know of several instances where we've had things as evidence where we've ended up the state paying in claims that, or at least answering claims that evidence and things that were seized or confiscated were damaged in our holding. And in this, at least if we bring it in, and if the citizen petitions for the right or challenges court to get it back, at least in this instance, it wouldn't be damaged. We would be able to transport the thing in. We come up and there's a trailer at the access. We can match it up with the trailer and take it in. Same with the other equipment. So this would, but this would just be motorboats here. Would that be jet skis? Motorboats and jet skis, I imagine. So. Any questions on the bill or amendments, I'd gladly take them.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, I seem to remember hearing something about the trailer issue, one of the last 2 years. And there was a concern that if the there's a violation and the boat is seized, the argument was if you don't take the trailer, the person has the trailer to sell and raise bail and whatever else may happen, but is it your contention that it's really a better operation just to go ahead and take the boat and the trailer together, keep them together, and hope they can raise money somewhere else?
Yeah, especially if we have to arrest some, Mr. Chairman and Representative Cox, especially if we have to arrest somebody on the water. If you are, the boats nowadays are worth tens of thousands of dollars, and with the locators and rods and reels and equipment, you know how much money a tackle box is worth. If this way you keep the unit together, you put it on the trailer and you take it all in. If you happen to take the owner of the boat in, you can't leave the boat there. Otherwise, you have to call an officer to watch, and it ties up manpower, and it's just a real pain. So that's why the. And if you want, if you need any more examples, you can give them to.
Thank you.
Representative Dennis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I am failing to get the connection between your amendment A1 and your bill. I can't seem to find where it fits. And, you know, probably I'm totally missing it, but it's the act prohibited here. And the bill that I understand you having here is one regarding the trainers and, you know, for firearms and for ATV license and all that. And I'm wondering why we slipped this little thing in with this one.
Mr. Chairman.
Perhaps if you want to take the trailer and the boat, it would be warrant a bill on its own.
Mr. Chairman and members, this actually is a DNR enforcement bill. It's not specifically related just to one subject. It's kind of an agency DNR enforcement bill, and we included these in just to have an enforcement bill, under the main bill. You could separate them out.
It's a very small bill.
Representative Pass? Anything further, Representative Pass?
No, I don't have any further comment. I just find they don't fit together.
Okay. Representative Lester.
I know enforcement fits together, and I understand that, but even in my short tenure here, we've been slipped things that I don't like.
Representative Lester.
Mr. Chair, Two comments. So one on the seizure issue. Representative Cornish is going to make it quite a bit easier for the DNR to haul this stuff in. Are we going to cut down some staff then so we can achieve some savings that way? But realistically, I can see the rationale behind it. However, anytime you talk seizing anything more of citizens, I have trepidation because, unfortunately, the DNR is just as human as everybody else, and they aren't always right either. And so I guess I have some concern with that. But the area that I wanted to ask about also, reading the summary of the bill, you're appealing a requirement for schools to have gun safety. Can you explain that, and what's the rationale behind that? Or is that not in the bill anymore?
Representative Cornish, I hope that's not in the bill.
As far as I know, Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, I had nothing in there about repealing anything to do with gun safety in schools.
I read that too.
It was in the summary, Representative Cornish, and I'm just concerned the language talked about it being obsolete, and I think it's more.
I see what you're talking about. I'll let Mrs. Watts, Mr. Chairman, explain that.
Representative, it's the language that's on. Let me locate it here. Page 3, lines 27 and 28. And it's a requirement that the language you're striking says at least one course must be held within the boundary of each school district. We believe that we have several thousand instructors statewide. The coverage is very good statewide. It'll depend on where we can find space at a reasonable cost and where, you know, the instructors live. We believe there's enough course opportunities and people's transportation these days, they're able to get, you know, distance rather than necessarily right in the schools. We didn't feel there was an issue with needing that language at this point in time.
So, Mr. Chair, so are you telling me right now you're not following that law?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that we know if we are or if we aren't. I don't know that we don't track, we don't record our classes by school district. They're tracked by which county they occur in. We would be able to tell you how many courses were held within each county, but the school district number is not information that we're tracking or maintaining, so I don't know if we could answer that question or not.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Western, one of the problems I had when I was teaching the course is you've got three school districts right together, and if you got all three of them put together in the rural area, you wouldn't even have five kids sometimes. And the requirement to have one in each school district can sometimes mean you've got three instructors for one person. And this would allow you to basically consolidate if you needed to and get enough to make one feasible class and a lot more efficient.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, is the language not requiring it to be taught to the school kids? It's a self-subscribed course, or is it one that's supposed to be taught to the school class in the school district?
The language, Mr. Chairman and Representative Westman, looks to me like the language that we used to mandate that you have one class in each district. Right. And this would release us from doing that. You wouldn't have to have it in the school district. You could have it in one district and draw from the other two if you wanted to. It wouldn't mean any less coverage or it wouldn't shorten you having available classes, but allow for the more efficient use.
What?
They're not necessarily held in the school, but Mr. Chair, Representative, the classes are not necessarily held in the school building. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're held in coordination with community ed, but there is often held in places like, I know in the city where I live, the police department's a sponsor. They're held right at the police department station. They may be at DFW locations. There's a number of locations. They're not always held in the school buildings themselves.
Well, it does, Mr. Chair, but I'm just a little concerned that we don't limit this. I think it's more important than ever to have gun safety training for people that want to use it and learn how to use a gun, and we want to promote hunting and fishing, or hunting particularly in this case in this state, and that's one way you keep it promoted healthily, and so that's my concern. I got to think about it for a bit.
Thank you, Chairman. Could I have Major Thielen address you for a second?
Mr. Chairman, Representative,
please state your name for the record.
It's Jeff Thielen. The Enforcement Division has approximately 400 firearm safety classes every year. The reason that we recommended that language be taken out is because we feel we have adequate coverage in the state of Minnesota. A few years ago we tried to put some language in. In fact, it's people want to refer to page 4, lines 13. We we had, and we tried, we proposed language a few years back that said the school district shall cooperate with the commissioner and volunteer instructors to provide space for classroom portions of the training. At that time, the language shall, the word shall was taken out because the schools did not want to provide the space free of charge. And so at that time, we have classes in VFW's, Legions, we have classes, sportsmen's clubs, every place. We would love it if the schools in the state of Minnesota would provide space free of charge. If this committee would want to attack that issue at this point, we'd love that also. But
that'd be good.
Okay, let's see. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, my question's on a different subject. On page 5, the valid firearm safety qualification indicator. I'm aware of a few years ago there were problems with the Amish community that they were reluctant or unable to get the electronic license because it assigned an individual identifying number to them that they felt uncomfortable for religious reasons having an individual identifying number assigned to them, and I think that was worked out with continuing to allow paper licenses for them. So on the firearm safety certificate, does this still, it says a valid firearm safety qualification indicator. Would that be an individual identifying number that would be assigned to a person?
It's a coordinator.
Chairman Eckberg, Representative, the reason, basic reason for that language is in the past we've seen with the number of people that sell licenses across the state of Minnesota through the ELS vendors, 16 and 17 year old clerks in Super America, oftentimes they were convinced to be able to say that the person had firearm safety when they really didn't, and they'd issue them a license. The person had never taken firearm safety training, however, they would then have a previous license that said they did. This language will allow us to put the safety training indicator on the license itself so that we can, they can then prove that they have taken safety training.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, so if I'm aware that there are safety trainings that occur in Minnesota that have Amish participants. I think they may have Amish instructors.
Instructors, yes.
Instructors.
Yes, sir.
So with, I'm not quite sure I got the answer there. So they would have there would be a number. If I was there, I would have a number assigned to me. There wouldn't be a an exemption for religious reasons for an Amish participant. Another way of giving them a safety certificate or...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hansen, I don't know if that would be a problem because they'd already have to have a number on their hunting license. Resident firearm would start out RF something unless it's changed, but there would be an identifier on their hunting license already tying it to them. So if they had the hunting license, it seems like they've already must have gotten over that problem of ID. This would just be another number that would reference their FSC, Firearm Safety Certificate number, onto the license so the clerk would know that they had safety training and they could issue them a license.
Representative Hoppe, to that issue?
To that issue, Mr. Chair, thank you. People already have a DNR ID number, with whether it's firearms safety or firearms deer or archery or small game, whatever. So they're going to have that number, and I would imagine that could just be tied somehow to that number.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, in the charitable gambling feature, could they use that money for students that couldn't afford the class, or how do we currently deal with some young kids that maybe don't have the means? Because if I remember right, there's a fee to take the class.
Kevin Eckberg, the fee
is for promotion.
What's that?
I thought he said Chairman McNamara.
Oh, no.
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 I'll let you work that out in the committee there.
Keep an eye on him, Tom.
The current fee for the firearm safety course is $5 with the allowance to charge an additional $5 that can be used for supplies. I in in the
And as long as I've been associated with the program, I've never seen an issue with people being unable to pay. The sponsoring organization, whether it be the Legion, VFW, if there are kids in that situation, will usually pick up the cost. We have even waived the cost a few times. I've never seen that as an issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dale?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, in terms of charitable gambling under 349, the charitable organizations can use charitable gambling funds to underwrite the cost of firearm safety training, and we do that in our community. We buy the guns, the ammunition, lunches, food, everything for the kids, and send them out with a conservation officer, former conservation officer Fink, and he trains them in our community. So you know, it's a good link. And one last thing, Mr. Chairman, I'm not crazy about that. I'm going to vote for the bill. I'm not crazy about this idea of keeping extending on these now to the trailers. And I was just wondering, maybe we should include in an amendment the trailer hitch and the pin that holds it in to the bumper of the DNR truck, just in case you forget that out there in the field, you know, so that we make sure that we can haul away their boat on their trailer.
Mr. Chairman,
something to consider.
If I can comment on that just for a second, having worked in the field now longer than this fine representative here, it really is a difficult situation when you have to try to find a trailer that matches the wide variety of boats that are out there. And so the biggest thing is it protects the boat in case it does go back to the individual.
Mr. Chairman, just to back that up, it's actually better for the owner, because if they're going to petition and get the thing back in court, the boat that they took, they're more than likely to get the trailer back too. So it's more for their.
Representative Westrom.
Oh, Mr. Chair, just a legitimate concern on this, though. Right now, as I understand it, under current law, the person who's having their property seized isn't having their trailer seized. So that's a financial asset they still have. This is allowing the DNR to seize one more thing, which, you know, at a minimum is probably $500 to $1,000, and many of the, if it's a boat trailer, probably $2,000 to $4,000, $5,000. I'm not positive. I'm comfortable with the DNR letting themselves use the trailer, but I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with the DNR not only getting to use it, but now also getting to take it away and let the person who, prior to this law passing, if it passes, has the right to that property, even if their boat or jet ski does get seized. Now you are seizing one more item of value, $1,000 to $5,000.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westman, the problem is, though, is that if you don't take it in, then you're going to have to leave it there, and you've got a bigger liability problem. And I've got people into jail before, and they'll say, where is my equipment? And they just go bonkers. And so this way, at least they'd be together.
Representative Westman.
Mr. Chair, then Representative Cornish, maybe we should add some comfort language in here that says, for the purpose of hauling it in and seizing it, they have the right to take the trailer, but to say that they have the full seizure of that trailer is a whole different policy question. I think that should be separated here from just using that equipment. And at a bare minimum, then, under my scenario, if the person whose boat is seized and they don't ever get it back, they still have a trailer to sell, as Representative Cox said, or to do something else, and the DNR at that point will have to figure out a way to move the boat or sell it on the trailer and then give the trailer back to the person. But the way this goes, we're authorizing them to take another $1,000 to $5,000 of property as a part of current law that allows the seizure of a boat or jet ski.
Representative Osmond.
My name is Chair, and I served as chair of the claims committee for a while. And we've had all kinds of ridiculous things brought to us to try and reimburse people for. And if the officers are going to seize the boat, they can't even leave that boat to go find a trailer. They can't. I mean, they're essentially then locked to that boat until they can find a way to move it into a storage area where it will be protected. Or otherwise, the taxpayers of the state will end up reimbursing the potential violator, for damage to that confiscated device. And I think that to when you take the boat to the water and it has a trailer, and you create a violation that calls for its forfeiture, you forfeiture the whole works. And that's what should go before the courts, and there shouldn't be putting our taxpayers at risk to try and cover somebody else's liabilities, especially if those liabilities are the result of them breaking Minnesota law.
Members, no one hates forfeiture more than I do. I'll tell you that right now. But I think that this is a common sense issue, and we should leave it in the bill and move forward with it. Like Representative Osmond said, I just think it makes common sense that we should do this. But I hate forfeiture more than anybody on this committee, I can tell you that. With that, Representative Cornish renews his motion that House File 42, as amended, be re-referred, passed as amended, and... Oh, I'm sorry, 42, 215, I'm sorry. I'm reading from a script here that is incorrect. House File 215, as amended, be re-referred to Public Safety Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is moved on to public policy and finance. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Thank you.
Members, next Tuesday, we won't have any bills before the committee that we know of, but we will have an overview of forestry issues, and we'll have the Department of Natural Resources, Forest Resources Council, and Timber Industry in to talk about timber issues. With that, members, meeting adjourned.